It is 23 and a half minutes after the hour on a thankful Thursday morning here along the Broken Road. It's time to, we're going to do a little experiment this morning. First of all, David Allen Punt is with us in a manner of speaking. He's in a deep wilderness area of just outside the border of East Dakota up there in Minnesota. David, we can see you. Can we hear you? Say something. Say something.
That's right. We are just outside the border.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the police tape from here.
Okay, well, it's good to know you don't go too far from home then. So, okay.
Yeah, right there, just south of Highway 10.
Okay.
Or Highway 210.
I passed by many times. I know wherever you speak. Also with us is Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie, an Anglican pastor. Typically, we talk to Robbie in Ashburn, Virginia. His church is in Leesburg. But this morning, he's coming to us from Nashville, Tennessee, where for the past 3 days, both he and I have been totally immersed in the Infusion Bible Conference, which many of the listeners will remember as the Institute of Biblical Context. It's been changed now. IBC is still the name, but it's the Infusion Bible Conference. And Robbie has spent 3 days. It was pretty intense, wasn't it?
It was very, very intense. I'm still unpacking all this information, but it's great to be with you. Thankful Thursday morning, where I'm used to being with you on a Wednesday morning.
That's so true. Well, I'm going to get my days all mixed up here. But unless I miss my guess, we intend to be doing this on Thursdays from this point on. Is that right?
That's right, and thank you for being flexible with my schedule that shifted, and I missed you guys last week. My week was not the same without talking biblical context on the Broken Road.
Well, we're looking forward to today. The thing is about this conference, let me ask you a question first, because I know that you spent a couple of hardworking years at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C., and you were a living history player. Is that what you would refer to yourself as?
Yes, a living history interpreter.
Interpreter.
So we
okay.
would basically be living in the village of Jesus of Nazareth in the time of Jesus' ministry around the region of Galilee and Jerusalem. So the year was around 30 to 33 AD, and we would play the part as if we were living in the village as a carpenter or a tecton, a builder, or the elder of the synagogue. We had the woman of the home. And we were living, immersed in the first century context, pretending like we were there. Similar if you would go to Mount Vernon or something like that and see one of the living history interpreters.
So you would have pretty well focused on geographically being in Israel, maybe in Galilee or in Judea. That was your setting. This conference, though, was all about Paul's Roman world. And that came to be the essence of the New Testament a little bit later on. I'm curious to know, how many of your visitors to the Museum of the Bible were primarily interested in the gospel accounts and the context versus, say, the Old Testament versus, say, what Paul had to contend with in urbanized Rome?
That's a good question. Most of our visitors were immersed in the context of Israel, the Holy Land from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, and specifically Galilee, the region of Galilee, and of course Nazareth, because that's where we were, though we would have plenty of visitors asking about the Roman world and, of course, Paul. But as far as we were concerned, we did not know Paul the Christian. We may have heard of Saul, the Pharisee, who was...
Speaking of playing in your role, then, you would not have, not have known Paul. Yeah.
But the point of interest is the influence of Paul's Roman world on our culture, because we were Jews. We would often get that question: Are you Jewish? And I would, we would say, well, all of us are.
Well, you were an occupied country. Rome dominated, did they not?
Right. So that influenced the way of life, and of course, Nazareth being a poor agricultural town, we were in the bottom tier in poverty, where the upper echelon of Rome, being extremely wealthy, and wealthy at the expense of the poor, of course, through taxation. And our connection with the Roman world would be you know, a great offense. Number one, the Roman way of life, the Greco-Roman way of life, is an offense to the Jewish religion, the Jewish practice of abiding by the Torah.
You would talk about tax collectors and zealots, perhaps.
Absolutely. And, of course, the oppression of the government, you know, the soldiers coming through. That was kind of debated whether or not any soldiers came through. There's no real trade routes through Nazareth, but a Nazarene would have been familiar with Sepphoris, 4 miles to the north, and, of course, traveled over the Sea of Galilee maybe for trade. There was a northern trade route that went there. But the Galilean would be very familiar with Paul's Roman world and its influence, but we would not have been familiar, not, at least not in our playing in the role of a living history interpreter in 30 AD. We would not be familiar about Paul's missionary journeys, but what we did for fun was paraphrase the New Testament letters when talking about culture. For instance, we might would say, you know, if the topic was slavery, we might say, you know, slaves, obey your masters. Mm-hmm. Or something like that. We would paraphrase it and refer to it, and it was a way to make the cultural connection without breaking character.
It's interesting that I'm sorry, go ahead, David.
Yeah, did you have anybody that in the village or your other players, were they playing the part of Romans or Roman citizens living in the village?
No, and there wouldn't have been any Roman citizens. Most likely there would be no Romans in Nazareth proper. It was probably a village of just a few hundred people in the time of Jesus. And most of them would be Jewish. And we know, you know, from the references in the scriptures to the synagogue in Nazareth that there would have been a synagogue there that would have been much like the one in Magdala, which has been uncovered. And we actually recreated our synagogue in the village of Jesus of Nazareth at Museum of the Bible off of the archaeological find that was found, I believe it was 2009, in Magdala. And so they also uncovered the Magdala stone, which had the menorah on it, which later we talked about at the conference this week, that the Titus Arch has a menorah on it too, unfortunately, after Rome destroyed the temple in 70 AD and carted off all the goods to help build the Colosseum.
Yeah, they actually sold the gold from the temple to pay for the Colosseum in Rome. It's interesting that you talk about Nazareth, though, and it was a small village, and it was composed of primarily observant Jews, very conservative, old-line, Old Testament kind of Jews, and yet within a day's walk was Caesarea, which was a thoroughly Roman town, and to our knowledge, Jesus never went there.
Right. And that town had a hippodrome. It had a theater that would seat 5,000 people. I've been to that theater. I've seen that hippodrome. Paul would have been in prison there. It's quite the place, Caesarea Maritima. And we do not have a record that Jesus went there, but, you know, in a 33-year lifespan where he never left a place that was 50 miles by 100 miles, I find it very hard to believe that he would not have seen that place or encountered it. Though I don't have any proof. That's just my assumption that, you know, someone as learned as he was and well-traveled as he was, because Jesus got around, but he spent 80% of his time in the Galilee region in terms of what we know of from the text. But
did he not correct me if I'm wrong here, because sometimes I get my Bible stories mixed up, but did he not hear us heal a centurion's daughter from Caesarea?
It was in Cana,
but the soldier came from, I thought, from Caesarea. Maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, and I'm not too sure where he came from, but we know he did. If it's the same account, he didn't want Jesus to come into his house. Was that the one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was his servant, I believe. Centurion's servant.
Well, he sent his servants. That's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So at this conference, then, over the last 3 days, there's a whole lot of ground that can be covered, because, I mean, Paul's epistles make up more words of the New Testament than the four Gospels do. The epistles, the letters to the churches, and for most of us, it's pretty tough reading. It's tough sledding to understand all the references there are and to understand why they're significant, why Paul chose to include such themes as slavery and adoption and the class structure in Rome. Is there one thing that stood out? I know that's probably a tough question to answer, but name one thing that did stand out to you from the conference.
Well, you've hit on it already just in your question, because what stood out to me was the issue of identity. And to an observant Jew, their identity is rooted in them being children of Abraham. But to a Roman, their identity is in Roman citizenship. And then you don't stop there. It's a class system. Are you poor? Are you wealthy? Are you the upper class, the lower class, the middle class? Where are you in the system? And so in Nazareth, we used to joke when I did talk about Romans, I would say, you know, what's worse than a Roman? Maybe a Samaritan. Mm. Well, what's worse than a Roman or Samaritan? Maybe a tax collector. Well, what's worse still? Maybe a Roman tax collecting Samaritan. You know, I would just like throw out, just to put people in that tension, that there were levels of like and dislike. I mean, you had the Jew-Samaritan rift, and that's a clash of identity. Then you have different sects of Judaism. And you mentioned the Zealots, and you've got the Pharisees and Sadducees, and all of these folks are just, you know, fighting for their voice to be heard and for them to be right. And then you've got the whole Roman world, which is, you know, gravitating or orbiting around Rome being all powerful. And then you've got Paul saying, when I am weak, I am strong. And he is assaulting these power structures when he says things like, there's neither Jew nor Greek nor slave nor free, but we're all one in Christ. I mean, these are all just disassembling the power structures and flipping things upside down and on their head in the upside down kingdom of God.
And from Rome and from this conference, you get the idea that it was all murder and mayhem. Almost from the inception of Rome, it was military conflict in order to dominate whatever territory they were working on at the time, whether they were Roman generals fighting each other or emperors seeking to succeed the predecessor with and then eliminate the competition. That actually is referred to by Jesus in one of his parables about the ruler that goes away for a while. And he's really referencing Herod's climb to power when he went away to the Senate in Rome and won appointment as the king of that area. So Jesus was certainly acquainted with Roman culture and knew the foibles of it and the inherent dangers of it. We got a major dose of it, though, the last 3 days.
Absolutely.
Classic.
And I believe Jesus got familiar with it through Sepphoris. I mean, I think that that's probably where he spent a lot of his time, as a carpenter building Sepphoris.
Well, and of course, it was thanks to the Romans that the gospel really was able to be planted and take root over so much of the world over the ensuing centuries. Roman culture, Roman trade, Roman roads. Paul had his hands full, did he not?
Absolutely. And speaking of that, geographical and cultural context is really what we dealt with primarily at the conference. We were talking about the geographical context of the Roman world, but we were also talking about the cultural context of Rome and the cultural realities of the day. And you mentioned Roman roads, and again, Jesus decided to show up in this place at this time in history, in a time where this network of roads, I mean, in a land bridge connecting Africa with Europe and Asia Minor, as we know it, is the internet of its day, this hub of information dissemination. And of course, Jesus would have been familiar as well with Roman culture from just it looming over the Jewish culture, shadows down from there, from the Herodian to, you know, the Antonia Fortress, that are literally casting a shadow upon the Temple Mount.
Well, there's great logic to the fact that he chose Capernaum for his base of operations, and some 70% of his ministry time was spent in that triangle from Bethsaida on the northeastern shore of Galilee to Capernaum to Chorazin in the north. But the significance here was that Capernaum was on a major trade route. And most of the commercial world passed through there at one time or another. So, you know, don't tell me that wasn't intentional. He knew Roman culture, and, well, he's God. I mean, he
But as a human, he did, too. I mean,
yes.
Absolutely. I heard one scholar say anytime you ask one question of Jesus, you have to ask two, because he's a 200% man. Mm. He's fully God, fully man, you know. He's a 200%. So we have to ask the one question about his humanity, but then we've got to deal with his deity. But yes, I believe in his humanity. You know, he grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. So he learned, and he certainly engaged with these fishermen who were trading on the Sea of Galilee and made Capernaum his home, which is a fishing village. And of course, traffic would be coming in and out of there. And of course, Tyre and Sidon. I mean, Jesus mentioned Tyre and Sidon. These are port cities. And he knows of their reputation as part of his insult that we had spoken about a few weeks ago on your show, when he does the woe to you, Chorazin and Bethsaida, had I done these works in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago. So Jesus understands the debauchery going on in these Roman ports, and he juxtaposes the Jews' disbelief in Bethsaida and Chorazin and even Capernaum, and says that had I done these works there, they would have repented. So we know that he is knowledgeable of these places and what goes on there. And we got a good dose of that, too, just understanding just the level of debauchery. I mean, they're fighting these wars, conquering these territories, looting these villages to fund a way of life. You mentioned Juneteenth, this new holiday that's coming up. And we learned that the Romans were off just about every other day. I mean, they had 50% of their time was a holiday. I mean, they were fighting to keep a way of life, you know.
Compare for us that both Peter and Paul met their demise in Rome at the hands of Nero at approximately the same time, maybe 67, 68 A.D. But each of them had stunningly different careers and different challenges. Take a minute, if you will, and just compare and contrast what Peter had to accomplish versus what Paul had to deal with.
Yeah, I've always been baffled by these two in their roles. This idea that Peter is the evangelist to the Jews, while Paul's an evangelist to the Gentiles, has never made much sense to me, since he's a Hebrew of Hebrews. Wouldn't you send the guy that knew a little bit more about Judaism?
But you wonder a little bit about, I hate to use the word predestination here, but Paul did his best to reach the Jews, going first to the synagogues in the cities that he traveled to, and he inevitably met with rejection and violence and personal attacks. And so he later came to basically concentrate on the Gentiles. Was he kicking against the proverbial goads here? By approaching the Jews?
Well, that's an interesting point, and it helps me even think through it and understand it a little bit more. I mean, I think because these Jews, these Judaizers, and you see the conflict with Peter in Galatians, where, you know, Paul, when he writes Galatians, but certainly Peter's in Galatians eating, you know, with the Gentiles and then hiding it with the Jews, you know, and there's that whole thing, but you see the second use of the law. So the Jewish Christians were still trying to hold on to their Judaism. And I don't know that they're not offended by Paul, that he's made such a stance in his leaving, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. His departure from Judaism, his hard teaching about we don't need the law anymore, could have been offensive, and he might have had, you know, better luck with the Gentiles. So I'm convincing myself here that that was a good idea, where at first, you know, I do kind of struggle with that, because, you know, Peter just, yeah. Peter, I just don't envision Peter.
Well, just
being
think
a very
of the human
evangelist.
Tendency when you're traveling, and we learned that during his three ministry cycles that he traveled on foot or by boat nearly 10,000 miles. And this wasn't casual walking. It was hiking over very rugged country with all kinds of dangers around him. And so I guess it's logical to think the first place he'd want to go when he arrived at a destination is some place he was comfortable with, which would have been in the midst of observant Jews.
He's out in the Roman world, and I think once you leave Judea and Galilee and you venture into the Roman world, I think those points of comfort are harder to come by.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the synagogue would have been the logical place to go, though, because he was a teacher and he was thoroughly educated. I mean, the man knew. In fact, one of the things they covered in the conference was just how well-suited, mm-hmm. how well-chosen Paul was for this particular task, how well-prepared he was.
Mm. Indeed, and that blew my mind, too, just knowing that three of those missionary journeys generated 10,000 miles from boat and land was just an astounding statistic. And it makes me ask, you know, and that's not even including this fourth missionary journey. It makes me wonder what I'm doing with my life, you know what I mean?
yeah. and nearly being stoned to death and beaten several times and starving and cold and exposed to wild animals and to robbers who were numerous across the entire empire, that he survived as long as he did is nothing less than, dare I say, miraculous.
Yeah, and Paul boasts in this. He boasts in these weaknesses. And here you've got all-powerful Rome, and they've got siege warfares. They're putting these, you know, ramps up against walls. The first one over the wall is the most valiant. And in 2 Corinthians 11, you hear Paul saying, I was the first one led out of the basket backwards, out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's Damascus, like, I'm not the first one conquering the city. I'm fleeing in a basket. I'm running. And he's boasting in his weakness in both 1 and 2 Corinthians. And he's really pointing to, you know, the subversive kingdom where we all have a level playing field and our identities not in our citizenship in Abraham or as Roman citizens, but our citizenship is in heaven. It's with Jesus in heaven. We are citizens of a new kingdom.
Another thing that strikes me from the conference, and maybe we can get into this next week, but it was the comparison or the pattern that Paul followed in his desert experience, and not only did Jesus have a desert experience, but so did Elijah, and the parallels between Paul's journey into Arabia and perhaps his visit to Sinai, retracing the steps of the prophet Elijah from the Old Testament, that this would have been perhaps his motivation in that.
In terms of his travel, Paul's travel?
When he came, and I'm not sure of the timing of this, but when friends lowered him in a basket outside the walls of Damascus so he could escape with his life, I don't know how that coincided, what time frame that was, with his desert experience, which turned out to be several years. And when in the Bible says Arabia, we tend to think Saudi Arabia, but it turns out, here's some more geographic context for you. Mount Sinai, the southern tip of the Negev, where the Israelites wandered for 40 years, at that time was considered to be part of Arabia.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, we've got a ton of stuff to unpack from this conference. And I was also, you know, I know we've talked about Pompeii before, mm-hmm. being frozen in time, but, you know, we had a reference to, you know, some of the cultural happenings during Paul's second missionary journey painted on the wall of Pompeii and preserved. So we really do get a glimpse in Paul's Roman world right from the archaeological dig of Pompeii. Mm-hmm. So there's so much to cover. This conference, the Institute of Biblical Context, now the Infusion Bible Conference, Paul's Roman world, highly recommend it. I know those videos are going to be streaming soon on their site. Of course, we have contextual resources on preservingbibletimes.org, mm-hmm. too. It's able to hang out with our friends at Preserving Bible Times at the conference and sell some contextual resources on the culture and context of the first century and Galilee and Judea as well. So it was a great week at the conference, and I was so glad to experience it with you, even virtually, so we were on the same page. But definitely miss seeing you there, and glad to talk about it with you today on the air.
Well, I'm sorry that I had to miss the experience in person there, but preservingbibletimes.org, and no doubt you can check there within a few weeks and find out more about the conference, the IBC, and the new streaming videos of that conference that will be available. And Robbie, the one thing that really struck me and still disturbs me is how similar we are to them.
Oh, yeah.
To Rome and in its latter days.
It was never explicitly mentioned, but the parallels were in every session between Rome and America today. And I can't wait to dive into that with you as well.
So much more to cover. Robbie, thanks so much. Have a safe trip back home, and we'll check with you next Thursday then, okay?
Well, wonderful to be with you folks. Take care, David.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much, Jim. We'll see you guys next time.
See you, Robbie.